key is, as Miller was talking about the other day, he was saying, oh, this will be immigration based on merit. That's exactly what they were saying in 1924, because the basic claim is Aryan whites have more merit.
And Steve Miller...
Bogus then, bogus now.
Now Steve Miller is being considered, Stephen Miller, to be the communications chief.
He does communicate their message in a sense.
Well, we want to thank you very much, Alan Nairn, for spending this hour with us. Alan Nairn, award-winning investigative journalist and activist. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Malkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, we have the 5 o'clock news.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Your unwanted books, records, and DVDs are treasures to someone else. Help them find new homes while raising money for your community radio station, KBOO. Bring them to KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We are accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Friday, August 11th. Please, no home-recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. The KBOO Book and Record Sale will be held on Saturday, August 19th. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
Books and Records! Books and Records! Come on down to KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th, noon to 6 p.m. at Cider Riot. There will be fabulous books, DVDs, CDs, and vinyl at ridiculously low prices. It's a fun community event that benefits your favorite community radio station. KBOO! Again, that's KBOO's annual used book and record sale on Saturday, August 19th from noon to 6 at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under community events.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, TriMet vehicles will soon be a little safer on the inside, with the agency getting authority to ban violent riders from the system for 6 months or more.
U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis released a statement calling on Pyongyang to halt its arms program.
The Canadian military is building a camp that would house up to 500 asylum-seeking refugees from the U.S.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 9th, 2017. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael doesn't like bullies, no matter their title.
No, there are some words you don't say on the radio, some words you don't say at all, but climate change and global warming aren't among them, Donnie. We talk about bullies in school, bullies on the internet, but now we have a bully in the White House, tweeting threats, shaming on mass media, glaring his wife into silent submission. And Donnie, any streetwise bully will tell you, don't pick on the crazy dude, even if he's half a world away in Korea. Our bully has the Secret Service and the Pentagon backing him up, but he better be careful, because the Pentagon is used to bullying the whole planet, and while they're disciplined and polite, they won't tolerate being dissed by an orange-faced, flim-flamming, non-veteran blowhard. I think Chief of Staff General Kelly will be scheduling plenty of vacations for Donnie, though having the secret state running the country doesn't make me feel any freer or safer. For Poetic Justice and Free Speech, this is Dan Raphael.
To update a story from yesterday, 23-year-old Washington County resident Demi Hellenius has been found safe and unharmed in Roseburg. She had left a seminar near the Portland airport on Friday. Later, her cell phone and car were found in Cottage Grove. Hellenius said that she left the landmark seminar on her own accord, and at no time was she in any danger.
TriMet vehicles will soon be a little safer on the inside, with the agency getting authority to ban violent riders from the system for 6 months or more. Currently, they are only able to ban riders for up to 6 months, but the new rule makes an exception for those who commit a serious physical offense or pose a threat to TriMet employees or riders. TriMet's general manager will have the authority to ban first-time offenders for up to a year and impose as much as a lifetime ban for subsequent offenses. The new rule, passed today by the agency's governing board, will take effect in 30 days.
On Monday, Governor Kate Brown sent out a fundraising letter touting her military background. She wrote, "I was born on a military base when my dad served in the Air Force in the midst of the Vietnam War." Brown was born in June of 1960, when the U.S. had fewer than 1,000 military advisors in Vietnam, and was years away from sending troops into combat. The base where she was born was outside Madrid. Her father was never in combat and left the military in 1961 when Brown was 1 year old.
Now we'll listen to a report from our friends at Oregon News Service.
The Justice Department has released a first-of-its-kind report detailing the best practices for handling sexual assault kits. In Oregon, the number is in the thousands. The report from the National Institute of Justice, the research arm of the Justice Department, includes 35 recommendations, emphasizing victim-centered approaches to sexual assault cases. ILSA Connect is with the Joyful Heart Foundation, a group that offers support for sexual assault victims and advocates for testing of every kit in the nation's backlog.
Having the federal government say this is the best practice is very much going to bolster our campaign to end the backlog by 2020.
While the exact number of backlogged kits in Oregon is unknown, an Oregon State Police report found that there were 4,900 untested kits in 2015. A 2016 law requires an annual audit of untested kits. The law also ensures that sexual assault survivors can get information on the status of their kits from law enforcement agencies. The report also emphasizes a trauma-informed approach to handling these cases. Connect says this approach includes the psychological reactions to assault, which can lead a survivor to remember events out of order or fail to remember more details. She says police sometimes dismiss a survivor's story because of this.
Trauma-informed and victim-centered approaches to working with survivors will help survivors stay engaged in the criminal justice system, and that in turn enhances and improves the criminal justice process.
The report recommends mandatory testing of all kits and that states set up a tracking system so that survivors can monitor testing progress. While Oregon requires law enforcement agencies to update survivors on the status of kits, it has not yet put a tracking system in place. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The word from 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Last week, U.S. Senator Cory Booker put forward a bill to legalize marijuana in these United States.
But tragically, in this country, if you're African American, you're going to be arrested for using drugs almost four times more so than someone that's white. I've seen that in my communities where people are churned into the criminal justice system, tagged with charges for nonviolent drug use, with using marijuana, in a nation where our lawmakers and our legislators have been using drugs. Some studies have shown up to about 50% of adults in America have tried marijuana. Look, I have seen children, young teenagers, getting arrested, saddled with criminal convictions for the rest of their lives for doing things more minor in terms of drug use than two of our last three presidents admitted to doing. And so this rank hypocrisy in our country, that is actually not even the driving force behind this bill. The reason why I'm introducing this legislation, which I'll describe in a moment, is because of the devastating impact it's had on our nation. It's not just the wasted taxpayer dollars, but if you just look at marijuana, And please understand that a study by the ACLU between 2001 and 2010, looking at 8 million arrests for drugs, they saw that 88% of them were people being arrested for possession, overwhelmingly for marijuana. So understand what happens to a person when they're arrested for marijuana, when they're convicted for that charge, when they get a felony conviction. What that means is they have, as according to the American Bar Association, about 40,000 so-called collateral consequences. This is what you know. It's so hard to find a job. You can't get business licenses. You can't get Pell Grants. You can't get public housing or even food stamps. So many things are cut off to you. Now imagine if those arrests are overwhelmingly concentrated in certain communities, where you have the churning in of the poor people in those communities, or the minority folks, or disproportionately large numbers of the black men in that community have been arrested for doing things that if you went to a college campus and really did the police work, you'd find that large numbers of those folks are doing those drugs. But what you do is you severely impact those communities economically. You create crises within families as people are being separated from their children. You hurt their long-term economic potential, so much so that there has been one study that I saw from a university that if we had incarceration rates just like our national, international peers, we would have probably about 20% less poverty in this country.
Again, that was U.S. Senator Cory Booker. We'll have part three tomorrow. Dean Becker, drugtruth.net.
Domestic airlines are bumping passengers off flights at the lowest rate since 1995, the New York Times is reporting. And it may just be because of the severe backlash following an infamous video in April where a man was dragged off a United Airlines flight. Overbooking flights has been common practice among major airlines who are seeking to maximize the amount of passengers per flight, up against a no-show rate that can be as high as 15%. But after April, where a total of 957 passengers were denied boarding, Southwest spokeswoman Melissa Ford states that the airline has altogether stopped the practice. United Airlines spokeswoman Megan McCarthy states that many airlines are showing more focus on accommodating customers and making improvements, one of which could see a payout as high as $10,000 in travel certificates for volunteers willing to change flights.
And now we'll take a listen to the latest from the Green News Report.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. On a sweltering day 2 summers ago, Randy Granillo was at work installing floors in a house near Dallas, Texas, when he started to feel ill. He asked for a break, but he was unable to take one. That afternoon, he collapsed.
When he got to the hospital, it was just too late. His body temperature was 109 degrees.
That's Deanna Ramirez of the nonprofit Workers Defense Project. She says after this tragedy, the Dallas City Council passed an ordinance that her group had spent a year and a half fighting for. It mandates a 10-minute break for every 4 hours of construction work. That may not sound like much, but it's more than many workers got before. 5 years ago, the Workers Defense Project surveyed over 1,000 Texas construction workers. More than a third said they were not given breaks at all, and over half said their employers did not provide water. As global warming causes more extreme heat waves, protecting workers is critical. Ramirez continues to fight for their rights.
Hearing workers say, oh yeah, you know, I wasn't getting a break, but now I am, it just feeds my fire to keep fighting for better working conditions for workers here in Texas.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
That was Climate Connections, and now we'll take a listen to the latest from Green News Report.
Europe grapples with relentless heat wave, flash drought causing crop failure in the Great Plains. Trump's Department of Agriculture nixes the phrase climate change. Plus,
the bottom line is always front and center when you're a shareholder-owned company.
The electric utility industry knew about global warming in 1968, but chose to lie about it and build more coal plants anyway.
Because of course they did. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Is that an iceberg the size of Delaware breaking off the Antarctic ice shelf? Or are you just happy to see me?
Both. This is your 800th Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, it seems you have failed.
How so?
Well, this is our 800th Green News Report, and the globe is still warming.
Yes, I have failed in stopping the global climate crisis.
See? Now, for people who don't know, we started the Green News Report 800 episodes ago, but even prior to that, when I was filling in as a guest host on a station up in San Francisco called Green 960, they had just changed their name from The Quake to Green 960. They were owned by Clear Channel, which now calls itself iHeartRadio. That station is no longer there because Clear Channel flipped all their progressive talk stations to right-wing talk. But the Green News Report is still here 800 episodes later. So congratulations, Desi Doyen.
Thank you. You
and,
too.
And thanks to those of you who have stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us crank out 800 episodes. And we'll thank you for doing that again as we move on to 801.
Woo!
But beyond that, what do you have for us today, Desi Doyen?
Well, first up, Europe is grappling with record-breaking relentless heat across the continent that's been nicknamed Lucifer by the media. The BBC reports Lucifer is the worst heat wave to hit Europe since the deadly 2003 heat wave that killed tens of thousands. This time, officials have quickly implemented emergency response measures, and there have been only 6 reported deaths due to coinciding wildfires. Some areas hit a record 117 degrees Fahrenheit over the weekend. Combined with high humidity and high overnight temperatures, that is especially dangerous since so few buildings in Europe have air conditioning. Officials say the high heat and drought has also caused more than $1 billion in crop failure.
Gosh, I wish someone had warned us 800 episodes ago.
Meanwhile, here in the U.S., half of the wheat crop in Montana and the Dakotas has been killed by a flash drought. Drought is a rapid onset of intense drought and heat so severe and rapid that plants and livestock simply cannot adjust. The Great Falls Tribune reports rainfall in some areas is more than 75% below normal. It's forcing ranchers to sell off cattle and farmers to quickly harvest what remains of the wheat crop. Losses could reach up to $1 billion.
That sort of crop failure is exactly what scientists warned us about decades ago, but, you know, still ignoring them.
Climate change intensifies and accelerates the effects of crop-killing droughts, but U.S. farmers won't be hearing about that from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The Guardian newspaper reports that internal emails obtained from the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service show that staff early on in the Trump administration were told to avoid using terms like climate change and instead say things like weather extremes and resilience in their communications with farmers.
Good luck to you, farmers.
Finally, it's been 2 years since investigations revealed that executives at ExxonMobil knew as early as 1977 that burning their product would lead to dangerous global warming. And yet, Exxon chose instead to fund climate change denial groups and mislead the public and its investors. Now, a new investigation has uncovered documents showing that the electric utility industry knew, too. The utility industry was warned back in 1968 by its own researchers that fossil fuel-burning power plants contributed to climate change. But according to lead researcher Dave Anderson of the Energy and Policy Institute, in an interview with the broadcast, the utility industry, just like Exxon, instead chose to build more coal-fired power plants and, just like Exxon, fund climate change denial groups in order to protect their profits.
The utility industry, over quite a few years after that, continued to invest heavily in new coal-fired power generation. So they were living with the legacy of those investments, knowing that they had a lifespan of 30 to 40 or 50 years. And, of course, the bottom line is always front and center when you're a shareholder-owned company.
I wonder if the bottom line will still be front and center when our crops are wiped out, our coasts are ravaged, and it's too hot to go outside damn near anywhere in the world.
Yes, we will be living with the legacy of the choices that they've made for decades.
For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us and follow us on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. And once again, my thanks to those of you who help us keep going through 800 episodes by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. Thank you. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Still crazy. Still crazy.
after all these years.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's Right to Survive, followed at 7 by Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. In weather, the patchy smoke continues with tonight's low of 62 and tomorrow's high of 88. Today in history, in 1945, the United States dropped its second atomic bomb in Nagasaki. The quote of the day is from Albert Einstein. Whoever is careless with truth in small matters cannot be trusted with important matters.
And now we'll hear some reports from the correspondents at National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Hannah Colton, in for Antonia Gonzalez. A man accused of murdering a Crow Agency woman last year has been declared mentally competent to stand trial. The Billings Gazette reports a U.S. District Court judge in Billings Tuesday found 20-year-old Demarzio Suede Sanchez competent after hearing from a forensic psychologist, who said Sanchez is able to understand the court process despite some substance abuse and adjustment disorders. Sanchez is one of three people charged in the death of Roy Lynn Rides Horse, who died in June of 2016 after being beaten and set on fire on the Crow Reservation that April. Sanchez pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder. His brother, Frank James Sanchez, took a plea deal that calls for a first-degree murder charge to be dismissed at his sentencing in October. The third defendant, Angelica Jo Whiteman, is also accused of murder and will go to trial next month. Two tribes are asking a federal court to immediately shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline until more environmental review is complete, but they also laid out a backup plan in case DAPL continues to operate. The Standing Rock and Cheyenne River Sioux tribes filed a brief Monday in U.S. District Court. It's in response to Judge James E. Boasberg's ruling earlier this summer that ordered the Army Corps of Engineers to redo parts of its environmental assessment. The tribes say if Boasberg won't shut down the pipeline in the meantime, then he should at least impose alternative relief measures to protect the tribe's interests. Those fallback measures include increasing public reporting of issues like pipeline repairs and implementing a spill response plan for the Lake Oahe Reservoir. Boasberg is expected to rule in September. Meanwhile, the North Dakota Public Service Commission is preparing a case against Dakota Access LLC for alleged violations during construction of the pipeline. The Grand Forks Herald reports the regulatory agency held a closed-door meeting Tuesday regarding their complaints, but has taken no formal action yet. Oil began flowing through the Dakota Access pipeline in June. The Cherokee Nation is aiming to eliminate hepatitis C among its tribal citizens. The tribe is presenting on its progress this week at the World Indigenous Peoples Conference on Viral Hepatitis in Anchorage, Alaska, which also coincides with the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples. According to a conference press release, nearly half of the Cherokee Nation population got screened for hepatitis C, and about a quarter of those with the infection have been cured. A federal humanities advocate and a Native nonprofit are teaming up to promote Native language education programs. They'll each contribute about $2 million to fund education programs within tribal communities aimed at revitalizing Native American languages. KTOO's Trip Krause looks at the partnership and what it might mean for Alaska.
Approximately 150 Native languages are spoken in the U.S. 20 distinct languages alone are in Alaska. Lawrence Kaplan is a linguistics professor in Fairbanks. He says Alaska Natives care enormously about their language and culture.
And the languages are very important to the groups because it's just part of their culture. It's part of what makes them unique.
The director of the Alaska Native Language Center, Kaplan, says all Native languages are endangered. That is why the National Endowment for the Humanities has teamed up with Longmont, Colorado-based First Nations Development Institute to fund Native language education. Kaplan says Tlingit and Central Yupik would be good candidates for grant funding.
to me, the languages that would benefit most would be the ones where there's an active group of people working already.
First Nations is a national nonprofit that focuses on economic development throughout Indian Country. President and CEO Michael Roberts says that includes natives in Alaska and Hawaii. But competition for the language program funding could be intense.
We are going to open this really wide, nationwide, asking for folks to come in and get into a highly, you know, a competitive process. And, you know, and there is an oversubscription of applicants, $2 available.
An advisory committee will be formed, and then tribes will be contacted to submit proposals. For National Native News, I'm Trip J. Krause.
And I'm Hannah Colton.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
A North Dakota judge has accepted a plea agreement for former Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein, The Guardian reports. Stein was arrested at the Standing Rock protests last September after walking up to a bulldozer and spray-painting the words, "I approve this message." Stein had initially faced up to 2 months in jail and a maximum of $3,000 in fines. However, her plea deal has allowed her to plead guilty to a criminal mischief misdemeanor charge in return for the criminal trespass charges being dropped. She will be on unsupervised probation for 6 months and will have to pay $250 in fees.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is...
Now let's hear what happened on this day in labor history.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1979. That was the day that young women workers at the YH Trading Company in Seoul, South Korea, staged a sit-in strike. The women made wigs for export. The company had been one of the leading exporters in the nation. But then the managers began to move the profits from the wig company to a shipping company under the same ownership, as well as to a film production company. This drained the profits from the wig factory and left it in massive debt. The owners shut down the company without warning, firing all of the employees. These women did not only lose their jobs. Water and electricity were turned off at the factory dormitories where the workers lived. A union represented the young women. The union planned a strike at the building, but the police were called in to break it up. The workers decided to move their protest to the local headquarters of the New Democratic Party. The party was in opposition to the leader of Seoul, President Park Chung-hee. The fired women were welcomed at the New Democratic Party headquarters. There, they decided to stage a sit-in to bring attention to their situation. The workers' sit-in only lasted 3 days. Then 1,000 police stormed the building. They overturned furniture and broke windows. They dragged the women out of the building violently. One woman, 21-year-old Kim Young-suk, died in the raid. She fell from the roof of the building in a clash with the police. 4 of the union leaders were sent to prison. More than 200 of the workers were expelled out of the city of Seoul and sent back home to rural areas. Today's Labor History in Two brought to you in memory of Carol Hillman, a passionate friend of workers and volunteer of the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at Workers Independent News as they do a special report on Kansas City's minimum wage and the legal battle that ensued.
Hello and welcome to a special Workers Independent News WinCast report for Wednesday, August 9th, 2017. For Win, I'm Joanne Powers. On Tuesday, voters in Kansas City overwhelmingly approved a hike in the city's minimum wage to well above the state wage, setting up a legal battle with the state of Missouri. Over two-thirds of Kansas City voters approved the measure, which raises the wage to $10 an hour, with annual increases leading up to $15 by 2022. The state, however, has other ideas, with Republican lawmakers passing a law earlier this summer barring municipalities from raising their minimum wage above the state-mandated $7.70 an hour. The new Kansas City minimum wage increase will be on the books for 4 days before the state law banning it goes into effect August 28th. Those behind the ballot measure have vowed to challenge the state in the courts, while other worker advocates in Missouri are pushing for an increase in the minimum wage statewide. Joining me today to discuss the Kansas City vote is Dr. Vernon Howard, president of the Greater Kansas City Southern Christian Leadership Conference and chair of KC415. I spoke to Dr. Howard on Tuesday while Kansas City voters were still at the polls. Welcome to Workers Independent News, Dr. Howard. Let's start with a bit of a no-brainer. Tell us why increasing the minimum wage is important for the working people of Kansas City.
America at large and Kansas City in specific, including the state of Missouri on state level, is experiencing widening income inequality. And there needs to be the continuation of this movement in order to bridge that gap so that America honors workers and honors those who play just as significant a role in economic prosperity as other elements of the markets. Profits are good, currency is good, raw materials are good, advertising, marketing, energy, transportation, all these things are a part of the economic mix. But everyday workers have not received a fair shake over the course of the last half century in this country. And it is time for people of goodwill to stand up, organize, mobilize, and do something about it.
You did just cite the growing income inequality in our country, but that, of course, is also intimately connected with other types of inequality, racial inequality, gender inequality, etc. Can you comment on this?
The disparities tend to have a pattern. African Americans, people of color, women, whites in rural communities, poor whites in urban settings, all tend to be disproportionately, shall we say, excluded from the economic boom that's taking place in many cities and suburban areas across the country. There's a nexus between income inequality and blacks, Latinos, certainly Native Americans, and certainly rural whites.
Republicans in your state legislature and governorship have taken steps to prohibit local governments from passing these kind of minimum wage increases to prevent you from helping the lower income workers in your community. Given the statewide ban on local minimum wage increases, what does that mean for your vote in Kansas City?
We're not surprised. They have blocked Medicaid expansion since 2014. We're not surprised. They have blocked the continuance of safety nets in the state of Missouri, whether it be SNAP or WIC or other programs that aid women with children and that aid the unemployed and the working poor. They have continued to underfund public education that primarily gives educational opportunities to poor people, poor whites, and people of color. So we're not surprised that they would block minimum wage advances because they, by and large, represent moneyed interests, corporate interests, and global international companies. So it's not surprising that they do this. Our response is this, however. We have worked with the city council to amend this law, this ordinance, if passed today, to go in effect prior to the Missouri General Assembly's legislation to preempt local empowerment. Theirs goes into effect the 28th of August, ours the 24th of August. So our law will already be on the book when their legislation becomes law. Theirs becomes law 4 days after ours. After that, clearly there will be a legal battle. And we believe that the constitutionality of the Missouri statute that preempts the people from going to the polls and determining their own destiny and outcome is something that is a good case. And we will take it as high as necessary to any court that will hear us. Mind your listeners and readers, the Missouri Supreme Court ordered this election in the city of Kansas City, Missouri, after last year we argued our case before the Missouri Supreme Court. If, in fact, our case was bogus, the Missouri Supreme Court never would have ordered this election. We're going to move forward, and we're going to argue the question of the constitutionality of a broader Missouri General Assembly blocking the constitutional powers and the local powers of people and their right to self-determination.
Speaking of self-determination, St. Louis, of course, already passed a minimum wage increase back in 2015. which went into effect in May and is now due to be eroded by the state law back to $7.70 an hour.
The difference between the St. Louis effort and the Kansas City effort is that the St. Louis effort and ordinance or law was actually sponsored by the city council and the government. Ours here is a grassroots organization and a grassroots coalition. I'm the president of SCLC, a traditional civil rights organization here in Kansas City. We were the birthers of the modern-day mid-20th century civil rights movement. We are the grassroots organization of Rosa Parks, of Dr. King, Fred Shuttlesworth. The list goes on and on of folks who have been a part of our movement. We will not shrink back. We will not stop. We will not be deterred in our quest from a legal standpoint to obtain justice for the working poor. The city of St. Louis might have restrictions and prohibitions on what it leads its city legal staff to do. We are a grassroots organization. We will not stop. We are moving forward to challenge the constitutionality of the law.
Are there other municipalities in Missouri looking to do the same thing, such that if you should manage to stop the state law, other municipalities will have already taken steps to provide economic justice for their low-income workers?
None that I know of in the state of Missouri, but you make a good point. That's something to be aware of.
Reverend Dr. Vernon Howard, president of the Greater Kansas City Southern Christian Leadership Conference and chair of KC for 15, thank you for joining us today on Workers Independent News. We offer our solidarity with your efforts. Is there anything else that you'd like to add as we wrap this up?
Thank you so much, and we are in solidarity with you. We are a broad coalition of Black and white and Latino and Native American. We are across socioeconomic strata. We are cross-racial, cross-cultural. We're even cross-demographic and geography here in Kansas City. This is a broad-based populist movement of faith and labor and activists and business owners and neighborhood leaders, young, not so young, and seniors who are coming together to mobilize and organize and exercise power to control our own destiny in our own local cities, and we will not be stopped.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 725,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
Earlier today, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis released a statement threatening North Korea to avoid actions that could bring the end of its regime and the destruction of its people. In his statement, Mattis ordered Pyongyang to halt its arms program. This comes just one day after President Trump warned North Korea that they would be met with fire and fury if they attacked the United States. North Korea's state-run KCA news agency released information today that Pyongyang is carefully examining a plan to strike the U.S. territory of Guam. The territory holds multiple army bases, strategic bombers, and is home to 163,000 people. In response to North Korea's plans, Trump tweeted about America's nuclear arms being more powerful than ever before. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson also assured Americans that they have nothing to worry about, saying that they can sleep soundly at night.
The Canadian military is building a camp that would house up to 500 asylum-seeking refugees from the U.S. The camp is to be located in Saint-Bernard-de-la-Colle, Quebec, in close proximity to Plattsburgh, New York. Construction of the camp has begun a week after Canada turned its Montreal Olympic Stadium into a shelter for refugees crossing the U.S. border. More than 4,300 refugees have crossed into Canada seeking refuge status since January of this year. Many of them were denied asylum in the U.S. and are looking for a second chance at attaining it in Canada. Due to the influx of migrants at the border, these shelters will provide asylum seekers with flooring and electricity while they wait for their applications to be processed. Many of the asylum seekers at the Canadian border are from Haiti. In May of this year, the U.S. announced that it would end its program that provides temporary protection to Haitian citizens in the aftermath of the devastating earthquake in 2010. Since then, many refugees have migrated from Haiti to seek asylum in the province of Quebec.
If you're listening to this story on the internet in Europe, be careful tomorrow morning when you make breakfast. Millions of eggs produced in the Netherlands are being pulled from shelves in several European nations because of possible fipronil contamination. Fipronil is commonly used to get rid of fleas, lice, and ticks, including on household pets, but it is banned by the European Union for use on animals destined for human consumption, such as chickens. The World Health Organization says fipronil is moderately toxic if eaten in large quantities and can have dangerous effects on the kidneys, liver, and thyroid glands. While the recall was just done yesterday, some European agricultural agencies are concerned the contamination may have existed since last November.
The phrase election fraud seems to be tossed around a lot these days, and it's being associated with countries ranging from Venezuela to the Congo to the U.S. Now we can add Kenya to the list concerning the landslide victory of President Uhuru Kenyatta, which opposition leader Raila Odinga alleges was hacked. Odinga blamed the loss on hackers, stated that the 2017 general election was a fraud. The people of Kenya might agree with him, as violent riots broke out across the nation on Wednesday, despite Odinga's calls for the president or for the people to remain calm. Protesters have been burning tires, blocking roads, and hurling insults as riot police fire tear gas in response. But now the riots have taken a turn for the worse, as Al Jazeera News reported, at least six dead from the riots. So far, several of the fatalities have been police and security forces involved in shootings, but random acts of violence have been on the rise due to the newly destabilized condition. Kenyan officials who are members of the newly elected president's party are condemning the riots, claiming that, quote, you have to accept the results how they come.
A grassroots campaign organized a 72-hour ceasefire in the city of Baltimore that started on Friday, August 4th. The hashtag Baltimore Ceasefire Movement was not affiliated with the Baltimore Police Department or any other part of the city government. The Baltimore Police Department did, however, keep in contact with Erica Bridgeford, a key figure of the Baltimore ceasefire campaign. The campaign did not start from a single group or person, sponsorship, or celebrity figure. The movement picked up steam through word of mouth and social media. Its logo, a black, white, and red sign that read, "Nobody kill anybody for 72 hours. The city of Baltimore, on average, has more killings per capita than Chicago. There's been nearly one fatality per day this year. In the last 2 years, not only have the number of homicides increased, but the number of cases closed by the Baltimore Police Department has increased to one of the worst rates in the country. 41 hours in, after a day of peaceful marches, the ceasefire was broken. The victims, Lamontre Tynes and Dante Johnson, were killed on Saturday, August 5th. Organizers of the Baltimore ceasefire movement say that they are heartbroken, but that their work is not over, and the number of districts that were able to keep peace for 72 hours is a step in the right direction. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Fox Wild, Zion Bro, Isabella Cochran, and Kunsel Dolma. Our producer is Kyle Caresi. Our engineer is David Kesters, although I'm going to put an asterisk in that because he was in the co-pilot seat tonight. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zales Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with poet and activist John Slaughter from Poetic Justice. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Eric Ascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, author Jamie Harrison talks about her novel, The Widow Nash, an old Western mixed with a Victorian classic and a fierce feminist twist. And at 11:30, Words and Pictures brings you conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. KBOO keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Hello and welcome to News from the Boo. This is your weekly update about what is going on in and around KBOO. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and today I'm really excited to tell you about a brand new KBOO show called Combined Culture Radio that is going to debut next Wednesday, August 16th, that is, at 7 p.m. Here on KBOO. And so I'm hoping to be